Seth Leibson Show, where it's principles, not politics. Now, here's Seth.
Well, welcome back. Monday, May 2nd, 2016. I am going to give you, with my good buddy Chris Buskirk here, something really interesting for your drive home tonight. Professor Stephen Haywood, he has the best title in the country, I think. He is the Ronald Reagan Professor of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. If that's not enough, he is also a blogger at Powerline, the best, I think, one of the best blogs in the country. Author of an upcoming book that I'm hoping I can get an early galley of because I can't wait until it's out at the beginning of next year. The title is enough, or maybe it's not enough to entice you. It is titled Patriotism is Not Enough. Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the Defense of America. Stephen Haywood, I promised the audience some political philosophy tonight. Last couple weeks, Chris Buskirk and I have been doing it, particularly talking about Harry Jaffa, the subject of your book, Our Teacher. Welcome to the show. Let's give him some political philosophy. What do you say?
Well, thanks, Seth and Chris, although I hope we don't scare off too many listeners by saying we're going to do political philosophy. But most sensible people would run for the hills when they hear that, I think.
Well, the Warriors game's not on until tomorrow night, so I think we're safe.
Now, here's what's so neat, and David McCullough discovered this. What people miss in their college years, they want to get later because, and he discovered this with his John Adams HBO or Showtime series, whichever it was, how many people tuned into that, how many people buy his history books even though they get no American history in high school or college. We've been talking about some of Harry Jaffa's political philosophy over the past, really, months. I can't tell you, I get more emails on this wanting book recommendations and essays and talks of his than almost anything else I do. People are thirsty for the good stuff, Steve.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now his stuff is challenging. It's not obscure or over your head, but it does require some concentration, right? I mean, it takes a while to figure out what he's after.
But he is a very clear writer, and I have to say, I don't know. That I think he's an easier read than an easier listen for those of us who sat or were privileged to sit in on some of his lectures. No, really, I do. And blessedly, Hillsdale and others have put up some audio of his lectures. But let's start from the beginning, Steve. Tell us a little bit, remind the audience of who Harry Jaffa is and why he's important today. You have been interestingly culling through writings of his in the past that describe beautifully the contemporary situation we're in. But take us from Alpha to Omega.
Yeah, well, I'll just say, just as a stylistic matter about, whether you think he is or isn't difficult. In recent weeks, and boy, lately I've really been marinating in his writing more than I ever did, even as a student, really. He's reminding me a lot of G.K. Chesterton in some ways. Chesterton's writing was very graceful, but there was a logic to it that took a while to get a hang of. But along the way, of course, Chesterton would always throw off these little one-liners that were very memorable. And, Jaffa could be that way, too. He had very sophisticated teachings, but often he would crystallize it in a single sentence that you could take to the bank. And so that's why I made a Twitter feed out of it, by the way. People on Twitter, you can look up Harry Jaffa quotes. And I throw one up every other day or so. And it's amazing how many of his profound thoughts you can actually reduce to 140 characters. But I think, maybe the best place to start with Jaffa, he's most famous, I think, for revolutionizing and transforming modern views of Abraham Lincoln.
Steve, let me stop you right there. I want you to go with that thought, but let me give the audience an idea of how he could write something simple with deep meanings. And I think my Arizona audience will appreciate it especially. How about this one? Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Well, that's the one I was just about to
mention. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm stepping on your toes. You
that's
go for
right.
it. You go
that's
for
perfectly
it. Go,
fine.
Go,
that's
go,
right.
go.
He was the author of that most famous line, I think, of any presidential nomination acceptance speech ever.
Probably.
The only rival line to it would have to be William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold line in 1896, right?
Yep.
And Jaffa was the author of that famous line for Barry Goldwater in 1964. And, of course, don't forget the second half, right, which was moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. Both of which Professor Jaffa could trace back to classical thought, to Cicero and Aristotle, showing that there's some permanent aspects to political life and teaching all of us how to recover those.
What I think is most interesting and where I wanted to go with you, Steve, so this was a professor of ours. I think it's fair to say he changed our brains dramatically, Chris's, mine. I don't mean to speak for you, but I'm assuming yours changed my. I mean, he gave me my career. Let me try it this way, which is the current crisis we face. Chris and I have been talking on radio. He joins me every Monday about the problem in the conservative movement. We may not all be supporting the same candidate in the primary. I'm pretty sure we all are not. But having said that, there are all these articles about the crisis of conservatism or the end of conservatism or the end of the Republican Party. Some of your power liners are writing. I mean, everyone's writing and talking about it. And what my issue is this, is we have had such intelligence in our movement, from our books to our think tanks to the scholarship, the kind of which you put out and so many of our good friends put out. Such great scholarship. Have we done a good enough job, perhaps we have not, of translating that great thinking, the great scholarship, as I put it, from Mount Olympus to the streets of Athens? Or is there a rejection going on, or have we forgotten what we've been taught? Talk to me.
Boy, I think it's all those things. I think the short answer to your question is no, we've not done a very good job. We've done a very poor job, and, you know, there's all kinds of reasons for that. And, gosh, it's such a large subject that I don't even know where to start. I will say this. I have been, just today, in fact, writing another – I'm just now trying to finish the book. I'm still struggling with the last chapter, and I'm writing a bit about how conservatives were slow, really until Jaffa and his students and friends came along, in recognizing the extent to which what we like to call the administrative state, you know, the post-New Deal government, the fourth branch of government, this autonomous bureaucracy that is coming more and more to rule our lives. We were slow to recognize that wasn't just an economic phenomenon, and that, in fact, it was another species, really, of totalitarian thought. It may not be as totalitarian or dictatorial as, say, Nazis and communists, but it shared, as Jaffa taught us, the same metaphysical root. The idea that human nature was something to be conquered and changed, to be done by, you know, a scientific bureaucratic elite. And it's very hard to communicate this, I think, with a lot of voters who, I think, fall prey to people like Trump or Sanders, to pick left, and I don't suppose Trump is right. It's hard to tell. You know, who want to say it's trade agreements, it's, you know, whatever, immigration, all kinds of things that are causing these problems. When in fact, and we've been losing our own ability to practice self-government for decades now, and conservatives have been slow to recognize how serious a problem that was, and have been fighting it, I think, at the peripheries with things like tax cuts, you know, cost-benefit analysis, fine things, all fine ideas, but not really getting at the heart of and stopping the advance of the liberal project.
Yeah, Steve, my take, and Seth and I have been talking about this for a little while here on the air, but offline too, has been that the conservative movement over the past, let's call it 20 years, has gotten lost in the weeds. The prior generation, you know, whether it be the Buckleys or Jaffas or Wilmore Kendalls or Irving Kristols or any of those guys who would, they made the metaphysical argument, they made the moral argument, and over the past, I don't know, let's say since Reagan left office, we've had a lot of policy people arguing about whether, you know, whether the appropriate tax rate is 28 or 32 or, you know, 29.5, and you miss 95% of the population when you do that. And my critique has been that the conservative movement has effectively swallowed the Marxist dialectic, which is to reduce man to economic man and not to moral man. What do you think about that?
Oh, I am in heated agreement with you about that. I think that putting it exactly right. To go back to you know, Ronald Reagan, he had ideas and talked about policies, but he always talked first and last and foremost about America, about the country, about citizenship, about very broad themes, right? And of course, you know, he always would skewer the liberals and the Democrats with his criticisms, often which were very funny, right?
Right.
And boy, we're sure missing that talent. And there is, you know, again, the reason we were taken with Jaffa's teachings about Lincoln is understanding the importance of rhetorical skill that has to be matched with the depth of understanding of the problems. And boy, we're just missing all of those things right now.
Why do you think that is? I mean, the people on the scene writing today just don't seem to, I don't know if they're not interested in it. I don't know if they don't have the background, the educational background to approach the world the way that Jaffa's generation did. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, part of it is a lot of people really are not educated very deeply. I mean, even a lot of I don't want to pick on individuals or generalize too broadly.
Oh, do.
Even a lot of conservatives are not that well-schooled on, say, the principles of the American founding. They may know they don't like socialism, they don't like liberalism, they argue from consequences, right? I mean, you know, we can see what's wrong with the liberal project. But we aren't very good at explaining what's right about the American project from the ground up in our own terms. You know, Reagan had that by instinct. And, you know, Trump, I mean, I have to be taken with something Chris Matthews, of all ridiculous people, said about him a few months ago, is the other Republican candidates are talking about government, talking about Washington, talking about policy. And Trump talks about the country. And I think they're right about that. I mean, in his incredibly inarticulate way, Trump is the only person out there who even vaguely talks about some of the old broad themes, and he makes a hash of them, unfortunately.
I remember when Chris Matthews said that, and I took that immediately, and I thought he's exactly on point with that,
yeah.
And that is why Trump is resonating with people. I mean, that's why you see polls saying that Bernie voters are more likely to vote for Trump than they are for Hillary if Bernie's not
right
in the race. And I think it's because, in a certain way, the idea that Trump is talking about the country as opposed to the politics of the country, that
right
speaks to a lot of people who, you know, they want to be Americans first. They don't want to be Republicans first or Democrats first or conservatives or liberals. Some do, of course. But a lot of people just want to see the country get ahead and Trump's rhetoric, again, not always perfect, obviously, but that resonates with people.
Yeah, and, you know, I think one thing that we really ought to have taken to heart a long time before this, but I think now it's undeniable, is that an awful lot of the Reagan Democrats from back in the 80s and 90s, who really were the people, the swing voters who made the Republican majorities, a lot of them, although they voted Republican, didn't become Republican. They may have been Reagan Democrats, but they weren't Reaganites, right? They were responding to something else from Reagan. And I think, all it really took, in one narrow sense, was it took a talented politician like Bill Clinton to flip them back, and that's part of what happened in the 1990s, but it's persisted, right? And so along comes Trump, and he's the next person to speak to them at a more elemental level than the policy wonkery that Republicans have been offering for too long now.
It's kind of like
hold that thought as we go to break, okay? We're going to go to break. We'll come right back with more from Chris Buskirk and Stephen Hayward on the crisis of political philosophy today in the conservative movement, perhaps in America generally, and especially as given to us from our professor Harry Jaffa. It would be an absurdity were our government to require citizens all like Abraham Lincoln, yet it would be an impossibility if it could not from time to time find leaders with something of his understanding. That's a Jaffa quote talking about the kinds of leaders we need. We'll do it with Steve Hayward in a moment. Little Steve Warner for you, another great voice. Steve Hayward, professor at Pepperdine, blogger, Powerline, author of tremendous books and biographies, everyone from Winston Churchill to Ronald Reagan, one of the great teachers in America right now that we all need. Joined here with me is Chris Buskirk from DownstreamPolitics.com. The crisis of political philosophy in conservatism. Steve, before the break, you and Chris were talking a little bit about how some of even our brighter lights, some of our leading conservative thinkers or writers perhaps are not as schooled as they could be or steeped as they could be in the American conservative understanding, or at least in certain understandings of the American founding. This was a problem Jaffa outlined for much of his life. I sent people to his essay. I think he had actually two now. The False Prophets of American Conservatism. He understood this. He put it this way. He said, a lot of these guys are just afraid of ideology. That ideology burned them once when they were communists or socialists, and they're afraid of it they've been afraid of it ever since. But maybe that does explain why some of Bernie Sanders supporters are inclined to vote for Trump. If Trump is doing an American ideology, the Sanders voters are nothing but voters are nothing so much as votaries interested in a certain ideology too. It's not that surprising to me in a way.
Well, yeah, I think the common factor between, say, the Trump Sanders voters, I mean, you can imagine them almost running as a ticket, right? I mean, they agree about enough things. I think what unites them is a disgust with what you might call the ruling establishment in the country. Lots of reasons to have disgust for the ruling establishment in the country. But it's become sort of a free-floating thing, and the conservative failure is not attaching the blame for the defects of the ruling establishment to liberalism, because that's where it ultimately belongs. I mean, the ruling establishment, in fact, the way I usually put it is, you know, bureaucratic government is the partisan creation of the Democratic Party. Republicans have failed to either, A, understand that, or, B, explain that in a serious way to voters. I mean, again, the only partial exception being Ronald Reagan, who did try and portray the matter in exactly that way. But you never heard anybody from the current field really explain it that way. Now, there's a certain immoderation to that, right? I mean, remember that part of Jaffa's project was making us understand the moderation of the statesman. That's not to be confused with being in the squishy middle of the political spectrum. Moderation means understanding the limitations of politics and resisting the cries of utopianism. And, of course, the problem with ideology is that it's usually utopian, and conservatism is anti-utopian. But that means that the conservatives are the real moderates in the classical Aristotelian sense of the word. I hope that's not too much.
No, it's not. That's perfect, because it tees up, I think, a problem that not just conservatives, too many of our conservative brethren miss, but many liberals as well. So the idea of moderation, the Aristotelian mean, you know, basically properly understood, is at the heart and requirement of self-government. There was a long essay that I'm not opposed to recommending, actually, in the New York magazine recently by Andrew Sullivan.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
It's not terrible, actually. I mean, I disagree with his conclusions, but some of his analysis is actually sort of interesting.
Yes.
But he jumps off the problem that Jaffa tried to cure, I think. Andrew Sullivan says the problem that has always worried him about democracy is in reading from Plato the line that tyranny is probably established out of no regime more so than democracy. But he stopped reading Plato, I think, at that line. No, I think he did, because
yeah.
I went and I immediately went back to look up my Republic of Plato where that is said. And the next line, after that is that the greatest and most savage slavery, of course, comes out of the extreme of freedom. That was Jaffa's project, trying to moderate the extreme of freedom. His book, Conditions of Liberty, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you know.
And the idea of equality as a conservative principle was the counterpoise
right.
to extremes of freedom.
Well, if you just think for a moment about phrase that we skip over too quickly, self-government, right? I mean, the whole idea of America is we are a self-governing republic. Well, to be self-governing, you have to be able to start by governing yourself,
right?
And one of Jaffa's great lines is, I'm not sure if I wrote it down, but I heard him say it, is that modern liberalism is the theory of every man his own tyrant. If you think about the way people talk today about, well, this whole business of, you know, how do you self-identify? Are you, you know, any one of 50 different sexual categories? You know, are you a unicorn?
And it can vary day to day.
Someone self-identifies as a unicorn.
Yeah.
So here's one of Jaffa's quotes. He says that the heart of postmodernism is the proposition that the subjectivity of one's convictions matters more than their objective validity.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
He even said another time, way back 30 years ago, he said, whether you want to belong to the human race is now a matter of personal preference.
Yes.
Well, you know, and here's where we are today. I mean, you know, Professor Jaffa left us here, 18 months ago or so. But, boy, he wouldn't be surprised about anything that right now seems to be shocking everybody else who's waking up and seeing what's going on college campuses and all the rest. So we've lost the ability to be self-governing in the meaningful sense of that word. And then you add to that, and here's where Sullivan was right. I mean, Sullivan has his good moments, and this was one of them, I think, in that article. I guess the founders like Madison and the classics like Plato and Aristotle were kind of right to be suspicious about the excesses of democracy, which is something that liberals have always resisted recognizing.
Sure, but he truly got lost, Sullivan, as perhaps so many do, in the true trees and not the forest. The title of the book is The Republic.
Yeah, right.
And that's what we have. We have a republic here that serves to temper and moderate all these things, to find the Aristotelian mean, to find what Harry Jaffa called our founding as the best regime.
Yes, Right. Was that a question I'm supposed to respond to?
I don't know. It was either a question or a Ted Cruz imitation. I'm not sure. It was one or the other. But this is what this is right, isn't it? People don't. I mean, Lincoln saw this. Perhaps that's why Jaffa saw. My favorite speech of Lincoln's is one he gives at the Sanitary Fair in Baltimore. Sanitary fairs were not about cleanliness. They were about hospitals, really, hospital organizations. So it was a Sanitary Fair in Baltimore, and he makes that great statement about the world has never had a good definition of liberty and just now is in great want of one, and how we all claim for the same word but mean by it different things. And he does a wonderful, perhaps one of the most beautiful expositions of it by comparing, you know, the liberty that a wolf claims and the liberty that a lamb claims.
Oh, right.
Right? It's a beautiful thing. But that's the problem, is we don't have a good definition of liberty anymore. Jaffa always tried to explain it in the context of what I said earlier, equality, which is not only just a conservative principle, but the dueling, I mean, I think the equally important, critically important aspect of our founding. I wonder if you might, when we come back, Steve, say a word or two about Jaffa's thesis on equality as the moderator to liberty here in America. He got in a lot of arguments with fellow conservatives by talking about equality. But again, I think because they didn't understand what he meant by it. We'll be right back with Steve Hayward from the Powerline blog and, of course, Chris Buskirk from Downstream Politics. For those that are down on higher education, just think about what a treat it would be to have your students, your children, study under a professor like Steve Hayward, much less the title he has, the Ronald Reagan Professor of Public Policy at Pepperdine, one of the co-bloggers at Powerline Blog. Steve Hayward, we were talking just before the break about the conservative case for equality. I hope it's not... I don't think it is. I don't think it's untimely because there is this new new fascination, particularly amongst our youth, with socialism, and their quest, the quest of socialism, is if nothing more than another subject that you write on, Churchill, is the equal distribution. His concept, the equal distribution of misery. But we have a conservative and a founding definition of equality that Jaffa tried to bring out, and I wonder if you might as well.
Yeah, although let me preface that by saying that there's probably no area, and I'll give an example too, there's no area where conservatives and Republicans have been more incompetent in recent decades than in talking about equality. And so right now you have Bernie Sanders and people like him who have been going around talking about fairness and, you know, all the money's going to 1% and all these kinds of things. And what answer are they getting mostly from conservatives? They're getting an answer about, the utility of income distribution or, you know, wonky stuff, right?
Right. He tries to make a moral case, and they come back and want to talk about a spreadsheet on efficiency.
Yeah, right. And that's, you'll lose that argument every time. I mean, the one person who has, I think, been really good on this is Tom Sowell, who is an old-fashioned political economist, right?
Yeah. And
he, you know, the question he raises is how much of my income, what's fair about you taking, how much of my income are you entitled to? I forget the form of the question he asks. It's very good, right? In other words, we aren't asking the question about what's fair about taking, you know, 3/4 of someone's earned income, right? That's not just. We don't talk about it in terms of justice. I think we need to take the claim of justice and turn it right back around and throw it in their face. You know, justice is letting people keep what they earn. Right. What you're talking about is theft, because and you know, it's a sin of envy, right? I mean, I don't think this is all that hard in the ordinary politics. The broader case about equality or broader problem that Jaffa directly confronted is this. It is true, I think, that a lot of conservatives have been dubious about that phrase in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, because modern radical egalitarianism likes to take equality and ram it down our throat, except what it means in practice is inequality, right? Because it always, again, sets up a government elite who's managing the rest of us. That's something Jaffa perceived as the people who scream the most about equality. It's like the end of Orwell's novel Animal Farm. What he was trying to point out is something a little more subtle, but not hard to grasp when you think about it for a moment, and it was the heart of Lincoln's case against slavery, which is no human being is by nature the natural ruler of another. We're all equal in our political rights. In other words, no man is naturally the ruler of another in the same way that a human is naturally the ruler of a dog or a horse, right? We can make distinctions between those kinds of beings. And so, you know, when you understand that no one's naturally the ruler of another, it means that the requirement for legitimate government is consent of the governed. And once again, to flip all the cards over, as they say in game shows, the mode of liberal governance today is not consent of the governed. That was one of Ronald Reagan's great lines in his first inaugural address, is we now have a government that shows signs of going beyond the consent of the governed. He's the only Republican politician who's made that appeal in the last 50 years. And that's really the basic teaching is it both you understand equality as the basis of our equal rights, but also as a limitation on government power. And as I say, there may be some subtlety to that, but if you spend some time with it, it's pretty easy to make out, I think.
You know, Jaffa was great because he always started with the epistemology, right? And he would always talk about the self-evident truths. And he would say things like, as you're sort of alluding to, he'd say, you know, there's a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. First, you have to know what a man is, and you can know that by knowing what he isn't. He's not the creator, and he's not a beast.
Yeah, right.
Right, but Reagan certainly didn't do that per se. He took that as being self-evident, but then Reagan went from there and made the case that, you know, government needs to be responsive to the people and that it is dangerous when it is not. However, my sense is that since Reagan, Republicans have been more interested, as I said earlier, in making economic arguments, efficiency arguments. Have become very much enamored of, say, Hayek or the Laffer curve or supply-side economics because those things are good and they're true, but they miss the point in a lot of ways. It talks about means and more than ends.
Well, the amazing thing is that the appeals to economic growth and economic prosperity, as useful as those things are, as Jaffa understood, those are means towards an end. They're not ends in themselves. And to argue primarily in that way is to accept, in fact, the premise of Marxism.
Right.
That human beings are motivated primarily or chiefly or solely by economic concerns, by material concerns. What Jaffa understood, and of course he's not alone in this, is that human beings are not primarily materialist creatures. And Jaffa wrote several times beautifully about on this point that, boy, people don't understand that the real appeal of Marxism and of socialism is not material and economic, it's moral, right?
Right.
And so, you know, when you are talking, when you answer what is essentially, and that's what's the energy behind Bernie Sanders, right? If you try and talk to somebody who's essentially making a moral argument about justice and fairness and so forth, with an argument for economic utility, you might as well be speaking a foreign language. Because you're not going to be communicating or meeting what's really on people's minds. And so Jaffa, as I say, was not alone in writing about that the appeal of socialism is not economics. And to think that that's what it is to completely misunderstand the problem.
And so you're a student of American conservative thought. Where did American conservatives take the wrong fork in the road?
Before you answer that, we're taking a fork in the road to a commercial break. This is a minor fork, a small fork. We shall return.
A crass economic fork.
We will be very progressive in that. We will return to the right path in just a moment. Of course, commerce is always the right path. We'll be right back with Chris Buskirk and Steve Hayward. Steve's going to answer the question Chris just posed. Where did conservatives get off on the wrong fork on this road? We'll be right back. Neil Diamond, a little Dirk Bentley, a little Maynard Ferguson, a little Harry Jaffa. What's not to like, folks? Steve Hayward from the Powerline blog, Pepperdine University, Chris Buskirk, Downstream Politics. Steve, we're talking American and conservative political philosophy. Chris asked you, where did conservatism run off the rails? I have my own answer, but you're my guest.
Yeah, you know, I think as a historical matter, you can identify sort of three periods that are problematic. I don't think there's any one moment or one thing you can point to. But one of them was right after the Civil War. This is something that Jaffa noticed, although I don't think he appreciated how fully right he was. You know, you would have thought the Civil War represented the vindication, or the aftermath represented the vindication of the American founding and Lincoln's understanding of it. And yet within a very few years after the Civil War, you saw this great fascination in America with German historicism, later with German nihilism, and the social Darwinists, often misunderstood. People like William Graham Sumner openly attacked the Declaration of Independence in the same kind of language that Stephen Douglas and Roger Taney did in the Dred Scott case. It's shocking to read. And you think of Sumner as someone who was a, you know, conservative figure or someone in the conservative libertarian pantheon. And, you know, he's indistinguishable from, you know, Southern thought on race, and the Declaration was only applied to, you know, white males and so forth, what the left says today. The second period, of course, is the Progressive Era. That's a complicated story, but, you know, Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt and all those guys, they sort of took the Hegelian ball of historicism and ran with it. Now, one thing is they did still think that America represented a superior civilization and that we should run the world. I mean, they were very much imperialists, unlike today's so-called progressives. And it's very hard to see very many people who perceive what violence was being done to the Constitution during those years. It wasn't until decades later that conservatives perceived that, and that's really the heart of an awful lot of the work about the administrative state today. I mean, I love reading George Will's columns because he goes back to Wilson and progressives. But no one was much saying that even 30 years ago, except for Jaffa and a few of his students and friends. And I'd say the third moment really is the modern conservative movement getting started after World War II. You mentioned, Seth, earlier you had a lot of these ex-communists who understood ideology. And I think especially the National Review Circle, who, except for Buckley, were all former communists, right? You know, James Burnham and Willie Schlamm and, you know, really interesting people. They
were brilliant
about understanding what was foul about communism and what was foolish about the liberal consensus of the time. But oddly enough, they didn't know much or think enough about America. And they thought the New Deal was bad because it was semi-socialist, and, you know, that's fine, too. But they completely missed this other story, I think. And that has only come into focus in recent years. And the point is, and I'll finish with this, to get back to the founding understanding of the country, we have to fight our way back through the progressives and the progressive movement, which is where the fatal deformation took place.
I forget who it was who told me, but it may be a good way to think about this and wrapping up everything Chris said. I mean, we don't have to wrap up yet, but putting a bow on everything Chris said and what you're saying and the ideology of the former, you know, of the new conservative movement after World War II, which wasn't just National Review. They weren't all former communists and socialists alone. Irving Kristol and
right.
Norman Podhoretz in their own ways also were former leftist socialists, Trotskyites. They all came over. As you say, Bill Buckley was really one of the only ones who wasn't. Perhaps Jaffa wasn't. I mean, he was a Democrat, but he wasn't a socialist.
Well, he thought of himself as a New Dealer.
Yeah,
you know, he voted
yeah.
for Adlai Stevenson, and I
yeah.
think he even voted for John F. Kennedy. And
he definitely voted for Kennedy in 60.
Yeah.
He said he changed his mind shortly after because he thought he was too much of a wimp on Cuba, believe it or not. That's
yes.
what turned him. It's always foreign policy, isn't it, with these guys? Even for Bill Bennett, it was foreign policy.
Yeah.
It was the Contras. But Steve, someone, and I forget who put it this way, said, you know, we who like to think of American conservatism, political philosophy, Jaffa students, we like the preamble and the opening of the Declaration of Independence. And we can cite and talk about natural law and self-evident truths and equality and liberty properly understood. Those guys, the conservatives that you were describing, they want to talk about the Bill of Particulars and the indictment of against King George. That's where they're more comfortable. They want to argue that. We want to argue the causes.
I suppose I can hear that argument. But, you know, if you read the entire Declaration of Independence carefully and slowly, you can make out in there all the applications of the preamble you talked about.
Yes, sir.
You know, God is mentioned four times.
Yes.
Once as executive, once as legislator, once as judicial, right? The supreme judge of the world at the end.
Yeah.
So you have the separation of powers implied in there. And, of course, only God, again, this gets back to equality and what is a human being, only God is the only being is God who you would trust all those powers in one hand. For humans, you may not entrust that kind of power, right? And then the Bill of Particulars, the king has kept us from the legislatures from meeting.
Right,
he's
right,
denied...
Right.
You know, fair trials in local areas.
Right.
There's the one line I love, which was, how's that go? He sent sent forth swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
Yeah, I like it. He erected a multitude of new offices.
That's
and
it, right.
I am looking at it. I'm not doing it off the top of my head. And sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people.
And is that not a description, say, of any federal agency today?
And eat right. out their substance. That
right.
is political that,
that's an indictment of the yeah. regulatory
yeah.
state.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's perfectly fine to read them that way, but I think that you don't understand it fully unless you join those particulars and the structure of those particulars with the preamble and the philosophy set out at the beginning.
Steve, fair enough. All right, all true. How do we regain this? Is there a way? I mean, you have this wonderful book, I think, coming out. When is it coming out?
February
of next year, because we lost these two great teachers who many of us knew, Walter Burns and Harry Jaffe, really on the same day, within the same 24-hour period.
Yeah.
They taught so many of us. Those of us that weren't in their classrooms read their books and vice versa. Those two started off as friends and ended up not so much. Maybe you can say a word about their division, why it's instructive to understand both of them to learn America.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had this terrible feud, which I thought was somewhat unfortunate.
Yeah.
I understood some of the issues, but they were both stubborn, proud guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were both former athletes. You know, Jaffe had been a boxer, and Burns had been a tennis player and a football player in college.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure many people knew that. And they actually agreed about more than they disagreed. And so I'm trying to explain what could be learned from their feud and what they were each about. And, you know, Burns' final book was called Making Patriots.
Yep.
Terrific book.
Yep.
And by the way, here's one of the things I figured out about Burns. By the way, he also, like Jaffa, very much not a retiring philosopher in his cave, you know, reading the classics and
right.
just thinking about his private garden.
Right.
You know, one of my favorite moments of Burns is when he went to the UN Commission on Human Rights as the U.S. representative, something I know he hated doing. And he gave a speech to the Soviet Union saying, essentially, y'all are a bunch of fascists. You're the same as the Nazis. He says, that's how you deal with the communists. Call them fascists. And, you know, what a wonderful guy to be engaged like that and stick it to him like that, right?
Fantastic.
And, but, you know, Making Patriots, he and Jaffa said almost exactly the same thing.
Sure.
Their understanding of Lincoln was identical.
Yep.
And, you know, to understand why you should love your country is a serious and deep question that goes beyond just the fact that it's your country or it's
yep.
the land that you were born in. There are good reasons for it.
Because it's a just country.
What's that?
Because it's a just country.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah.
Someone told me, a student of both of theirs said, Walter Burns taught me that a professor could love America. Harry Jaffa taught me why.
Right.
Steve, it is your job to keep doing the both of those for everyone in the reading world in America. We need you just now. I want to thank you for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you.
Thanks,
Jeff.
Steve.
Bye, Chris.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Have a good dinner, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.